onto Mane, and Liverpool lead.
The Premier League is back, and Off the Ball is the only place you can hear live commentary of Liverpool's march to the title, the battle for the Champions League places, and the fight for survival. Every big game exclusively live between now and the end of the season, starting this Wednesday from 7 p.m. with Manchester City against Arsenal. Yeah! And we'll also have live score updates on the OTB Sports app. OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the OTB Sports app.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So there are conversations, not least in the UK and the US at the moment, about our relationship with history, what we celebrate, what we might need to revisit, and even the GAA at the moment is not immune to that conversation. To discuss, we have with us Brian Hanley, historian. We have Mick Foley of the Sunday Times as well. Yesterday in the Mail on Sunday, as is his general habit, Mark Gallagher had a brilliant piece which Brian Hanley features in, and we wanted to tease it out a touch more. It came up in the paper review, and we thought it was worth discussing in a more prolonged fashion. So this is about John Mitchell. There are, of the 1,600 GAA clubs on the island, certainly in Mark's piece, he estimated at least 10 of them named in honour of John Mitchell. And we're going to discuss the rights and wrongs of that, especially at the moment in the current climate. Already we've seen from texts coming in or tweets coming in, there are other examples. There is an element of whataboutery, and if we talk about John Mitchell, then we have to talk about X, Y, and Z, or this person and that person. Equally, lots of people are saying, if we do this, then we have to do this, this, and this. Where does it end? I'm not unsympathetic to the complexity of those points, but for the purpose of this conversation, let's just start with John Mitchell. Let's just talk about John Mitchell, and then we can worry about where that might lead us afterwards, I think is the best plan. So Mick Foley from the Sunday Times is with us. Brian Hanley is with us as well. Brian, thanks so much for joining us. There'll be a huge swathe of people vaguely aware of certain, I almost don't want to name clubs around the country, but Mitchell's, some well-known, very successful clubs. And we'll just assume John Mitchell was an icon in some respects, or certainly a very well-known figure in the Irish nationalist movement of the 19th century, and that is all, and that was it. So they may not be aware of the full picture. Give us a sense of Mitchell. He was born in County Derry, studied law at Trinity, and became involved in the nationalist movement. I know he started the United Irishman newspaper in the 1840s.
Yeah, I mean, Mitchell was a huge figure in 19th century Irish nationalism. It's easy to kind of underestimate now how big a figure he was. I mean, this is a guy that Páraic Pearce and Arthur Griffith and so on all regarded as an idol. And in the 1840s, he was involved with the Young Irelanders. He fell out with many of them because he felt they were too conciliatory, that they weren't militant enough. By 1848, he believed the only path for Ireland was armed resistance to Britain. And he was hopeful of some form of rebellion. He's obviously deeply influenced by the tragedy of the famine, which is taking place at the time. The United Irishman is his newspaper, and that's what leads to him being arrested and tried for proposing insurrection, essentially, and being deported to what's now Tasmania. But really, his writings about his time in prison, jail, journal, and particularly a little booklet that he wrote in the 1850s about the famine, which is entitled The Last Conquest of Ireland, Perhaps? Where Mitchell argued that the Lord Almighty sent the potato blight, but the English created the famine. These had a huge impact on Irish Republicans and on nationalists generally throughout the 1800s. And Mitchell was really famous for uncompromising hostility to Britain, a belief that ultimately Irish freedom would only come about through force, and also then, in many ways, a real hatred of everything that Britain represented. And he believed that the British economy, industrial capitalism as it was becoming, had destroyed Ireland, had inflicted grievous harm on the people, you know, particularly during the famine, which he saw as part of a plot by the British to essentially destroy the Irish race. And that's the kind of terms that would have been used at the time. So Mitchell is a really, really well-known writer, polemicist. He escapes from Van Diemen's Land, gets to the United States in 1853. He's given a huge civic reception in New York. New York's already a very Irish city by 1853. And this guy arrives, as you can imagine, having escaped from a British prison, and he's given a huge, huge reception. The militias and so on turn out. There's a 21-gun salute, and he's interviewed by all the papers, and is really, you know, regarded as a big figure in Irish politics at the time. And his writings, as I say, have a long-lasting impact.
So talk to us then about the less savoury aspects of his views, and they very much emerge in his writings over in the States, and they focus on slavery.
Yeah, even before he got to the States, he'd joked, and I mean, I'm using the term in inverted commas, that he'd like to possess a plantation stocked with healthy Negroes. And he was contemptuous. By the 1850s, there's a huge debate in the United States, as you can imagine, about slavery. And Mitchell immediately argues that slavery is not so bad in comparison to what he sees as the crimes of industrial capitalism or the crimes of British rule in Ireland. He's an unashamed racist. He believes that the slaves in Africa were barbarians and that actually bringing them to the New World as slaves improved them somewhat. He believes that their lives in the South are pretty okay, that they're better than the lives of the Irish immigrants working in the mills of Massachusetts and upstate New York and so on, and they're certainly better than the lives of the Irish peasantry in Ireland. And he clashes immediately with the abolitionist movement. There's a lot of reasons for that in terms of the position of the Irish in the United States at the time. But Mitchell really is virulently pro-slavery, and as a result he gets quite a hearing in the South, and he leaves New York. New York reminds him too much of Britain, an industrial urban setting, and he moves to near Knoxville, Tennessee, where he establishes a newspaper called the Southern Citizen. And the Southern Citizen promotes the idea of the South as an idyllic society. Mitchell argues that the South essentially resembles Ireland and the North is England, her old enemy. And he says that the South's economy, a rural pastoral economy based on the plantation system, is a very fair society for the white man. And he's, again, unashamed to argue that all he's concerned about is the white man, and that slavery is a natural part of that society, that it's, you know, and I've read quite a bit of what he wrote at the time because I taught Irish-American history, and he writes, you know, there's nothing better than to give a young teenager a present of a slave. It's like giving them a horse. And like a horse, you've got to use the whip sometimes, but that teenager will learn very good values from his treatment of his slave and so on. So he's really, I mean, absolutely unashamedly a racist, a white supremacist. There's a debate in America at the time about the slave trade, because the slave trade between the United States and Africa had been abolished. So the slaves who lived in the US increasingly were people who had been born there. Mitchell is one of the people arguing for reopening the slave trade from Africa. He says we need more slaves. There's also a debate whether slavery should be allowed in the newer states of the Union. And this is one of the issues which leads to war between the North and the South. And Mitchell, of course, is, yes, of course, it should be expanded. This should be a system that's in existence right across the South and the West. So even by the standards of some in the South, he's quite extreme. And some of the Southerners argue that Mitchell is actually, you know, a bit of a liability, because Northerners are always able to point to him as, this is, you know, this is the politics of your society. Utterly unashamed racism.
Okay, that's a key point, even by the standards of his day, because sometimes we can judge people sometimes unfairly or not taking a full cognizance of the time in which they lived. So even by the standards of his day. Mick Foley of the Sunday Times is with us as well. So Mick, we're not looking to start some kind of culture war here. We're not looking to antagonize people, but it's a discussion that needs to be had increasingly. If we are now living in a diverse society and we are choosing what we celebrate and what we don't, then we really have to ask ourselves if, you know, black children should be playing or asked to play under the Mitchell's name. That is a discussion that needs to be had.
Oh, absolutely. I think so. And I think, you know, it's in a lot of ways, I suppose, you know, the naming of GA clubs has reflected in some ways different eras and different things that were in vogue, if you like, at particular. So, as Brian has outlined there really well, John Mitchell was a hero, really, to a lot of Irish Republicans at a particular period of Irish history in the early 20th century, and would have represented something different from what we know of him in the totality, if you like, around his views on slavery and so on. And those views on slavery, I would imagine, wouldn't have gotten an awful lot of traction in Ireland at the time, or attention, they would have looked at John Mitchell in a different way to how we would now when we discuss him. So in the same way, views evolve, history evolves, our education around things evolves, the way we see things evolves. And in the same way, you know, GAA clubs and the GAA itself are right to look at how their names and how their symbols and how their flags and how their songs impact on the wider world around them. So from that point of view, I think it sounds like something. I'd imagine there will be members of those clubs who will look and say, this is an unnecessary imposition on us. This is tainting us in a way that we never even imagined we would be seen. And I don't think it should be seen that way. I think by the club members in question and by the wider GAA community as a whole, it should be seen as just a continuing evolution. I mean, our communities and our societies all around us are in constant change. And the kind of questions and the kind of issues that we face now compared to 100 years ago or 50 or 40 or 30 years ago, some of them mightn't fundamentally change, but the nuance and the volume of some of them will go up and go down. So therefore, they require a particular kind of reflection and a particular kind of thought process at a given state of time. So with all that in mind, of course, absolutely, the naming of the use, I should say, and the commemoration of John Mitchell in this way should be looked at. And I suppose it's even more so than statues in a way, because his name is being invoked, you know, and I think there is a power to invoking someone's name like that, over and down through the decades, even if you don't know anything about them, it gives that name and that story a different life. So I think it is something that needs to be looked at.
Brian, what's your view on what should happen? You're looking at the moment, I'm sure, as a student of history, at the statue situation, not least in the UK, and how we try and decide what stays and what goes and why, and it's a complicated process. What do you think should happen when it comes to John Mitchell and the GAA?
I think it's an opportunity for a discussion within the GAA, but also within those clubs, because, I mean, I think it's fair to say not one of those clubs was founded by people to honour Mitchell's views on slavery. His views on slavery were well known in Ireland in the 1860s and 1870s, and they were controversial then. But certainly by the time the GAA gets going, of course, again, it's not unusual for GAA clubs to be named after people who never played Gaelic sports, but of course Mitchell didn't play Gaelic sports, but... You know, I think the clubs aren't named after him because of his racism, but we're at a stage now where many of those clubs, people have told me, do include players and underage players and so on who come from African backgrounds or other ethnic backgrounds and so on. And I think there does need to be a discussion then about why the club is named after someone who, in other contexts, is very well known because of his racism. This is even a discussion that they're having in Tennessee, because there's plaques to Mitchell and so on near Knoxville. People are discussing that at the moment. So I think it's an opportunity for a discussion, but I think it needs to come from club people themselves and from volunteers and members of those clubs, because particularly with the GAA, not only with them, people can be resistant to being told what to do, and particularly to be being told what to do by people who they might perceive as people who weren't that interested in the GAA in the first place. Mm. So I think that they do need to say, look, our club has this title. It's had it for however, what length of time. Can we have a discussion about this and talk about Mitchell's views, talk about those who disagreed with Mitchell, because say, Thomas Francis Marr, another young Irelander who fights on the other side in the American Civil War, you know, is a supporter of emancipation, supporter of abolition and so on. So there is contrasting views at the time that we can look to and argue about, but have that discussion.
Yes. Mick, I must say in my mind, and as somebody who did play GAA and is of the GAA world, there is no doubt in my mind that we shouldn't be expecting children. I mean, well, sorry, it doesn't actually matter the race, but particularly black children to play under the Mitchell's banner. It just, when we know what we now know, it just doesn't work for me. It doesn't make sense. I suppose, as Brian has alluded to there, people in these clubs shouldn't be tainted, victimised. The nature of the conversation should be absolutely very fair. And there will be people in the clubs, Mick, who played for Mitchells, who loved Mitchells, whose father played for Mitchells, whose father before him played for Mitchells, and whose father before him played for Mitchells. And it is associated with nothing but goodness. And there will, I suspect, be a resistance. But when it's all laid out, Mick, I think the points made by Brian outweigh whatever residual gra there is for playing for Mitchells.
Well, I think absolutely. I don't think anybody is arguing here that John Mitchell's views in any way should be held up as some sort of a an example. But at the same time, I think Brian is also right in the sense that this should come from the clubs. It should come from the people of the clubs.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best way to have it. Always in the GAA and in wider society, this is an opportunity for education, not for telling people what they have to do.
Yes.
I think that the conversations that are being had now around racism and around our interaction as a wider community with the people who live among this community that may not have been here 20, 30 years ago or whatever, those conversations will hopefully promote that idea that, look, okay, that was the name, but it doesn't. It's not reflective of our views. And I'm a great believer as well that, you know, no more than language and flags and stuff like that. That in a club situation, a club is about people, and it's about the people who inhabit that club, and it's about the values that those people hold. And GAA clubs rightly have been celebrated, particularly over the last 3 or 4 months, for all the things they've done for people in the community all across the country, in lots of different ways during this lockdown. And I think those values, I think when these conversations are had, I would like to think that those values will shine through, and that the idea that this is being imposed by some kind of PC brigade that don't really understand what we're about, that, well, maybe let's try and understand. This is what I come back again to, that idea about education and self-awareness within the GAA. Well, let's understand what we're about. What are we about as the GAA? And I you know, what are we as a club about? You know, what message do we want to send out to people in all corners of our community? And let the conversation go from there, and let them make their decision. And I would agree with you, if I was a club member in a Mitchell's club, we'll say, I would be in favour of changing the name. But that's just my view. I would like to see that conversation had. I would like to see that conversation had, and I would like to see people move forward together on something like this. And hopefully that would be what would happen in these scenarios.
Yes. Brian, do you want to come in on that point, so it's not just PC gone mad, media lecturing us, you know, people forcing this on us, kind of a acrimonious situation. The best route to a conversation. Do you agree with Mick that it should be from within the club? Maybe the GAA at central level might initiate that in certain clubs if they're of a similar opinion?
Yeah, I think it is better to come from within the clubs and from the GAA itself. I mean, I think people who have any kind of expertise in the history can maybe assist in that. Yeah. But it really does need to come from the clubs themselves, because if it's imposed or seen to be imposed, particularly from outside, there will be people who resent it then. And it'll even get a certain rebel glamour, you know, in terms of, well, we weren't allowed to do this because somebody was very concerned about something that happened 150 years ago. I mean, I think there's a whole history, unfortunately, of the Irish in the United States from the 1830s onwards, and of the Irish in the American Civil War, that is, you know, worth retelling and worth discussing. And some of it is good and some of it is bad. I mean, people might be surprised to learn that a lot of the Confederate Army's uniforms were actually produced in Limerick during the 1860s, because we were part of the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom traded with the Confederacy during the Civil War. But thousands of Irishmen died in the Civil War. There was a huge Irish death toll in it, in the American Civil War. And that is part of the context for these arguments as well. And they were contested at the time. It's not simply people in 2021, you know, saying that we've discovered John Mitchell was wrong. You know, in the 1840s and 1850s, people argued with him as well.
To end things off, just another point, Mick. I saw, I think it was in the Washington Post, actually, that the news of the Confederate flag and Cork had featured there. It was in the Washington Post newspaper. So the latest, the Cork GAA chairperson, Tracy Kennedy, has said effectively, and this flares up and has done routinely for a long time now, but the latest stance Cork are taking on the Confederate flag is it will be confiscated if it's brought into games.
Yeah, I saw that article myself, actually, in the Washington Post. And like, this is, as you say, this is something that's kind of been knocking around for about 5 years, really, now, in a kind of a in a repetitive sort of way. It came up in 2015, it came up in 2016, and more so came up in 2017 around the time of Charlottesville. And there was calls at that time. The Cork County Board asked supporters to refrain from bringing the Confederate flag to Stars and Bars to games, because, I mean, down the years, I mean, I started going to games as a kid in the 80s, and you would have seen plenty of Stars and Bars, and you would have seen the rising sun, the Imperial flag. It's still used, I think, by the Japanese Navy now. Would have been in vogue that time. Well, actually, anything with red on it was in vogue. Mm. And obviously, I suppose the rebel connection, if you like, maybe might have prodded a few people, but it was largely, I think, when you looked at the crazy kind of variety of flags you'd have among the Cork support, I think it was probably more the red thing than anything. But yeah, it came up in 2017. They asked them to refrain from bringing the flags, but a few reared up a Cork and All-Ireland hurling semi-final that year against Waterford. Mm. And there was a few visible on Hill 16. So this time around, they're saying ban it. Personally, I think they should have just banned it in 2017. Mm. I'm not 100% sure. I haven't looked at the detail of this, but I presume this applies to Cork alone, to Cork grounds and to Páirc Uí Chaoimh. So we'll see. And look, we don't know how. I would expect, I mean, in fairness, I think to the Cork support, I don't think any of them would have brought that in knowing the connotations. And then again, we have this kind of, as we've kind of mentioned in passing here, this idea that when you're told not to do something, you won't do it. Now, how a ban is going to impact. I think 3 years on in 2020, in the climate we're living in now, with the post George Floyd discussions that are going on and all of these conversations, I think there'll be a different view on the Confederate flag, even to 3 years ago.
Well, it's been banned at NASCAR, so if we can't keep it at a GAA, then there's trouble. Brian, I really have to go. So if you can even keep this, Brian, sorry to put you under pressure, even to 30 seconds. There's lots of texts coming in saying, where will this end? Which is, you know, and at the outside, I said, well, let's just talk about John Mitchell for this conversation. To broaden that to finish, where might it end? Say John Mitchell's name is revoked. Are there numerous other clubs with very problematic names, or was Mitchell a touch of an outlier?
Well, I think, you know, the Mitchell question has arisen because race and racism is a very central issue, and is an important issue in Ireland as well. And where will it end? Well, I think every part of the GAA should discuss its history and why. You know, when Cork fans talk about Rebel Cork, they assume that's the War of Independence, but it's not. Rebel Cork was a term given by King Henry VII to Cork because they were in favour of a rival to the English throne. So, you know, if you're going to talk about Rebel Cork and you mean it to be about Tom Barry and so on, you know, at least get it right. And so I think that it would do no harm for every club to know their history. Mm. That doesn't mean they have to change their names. Doesn't mean they have to disagree with the people that they're named after. But it does mean, I think, that, you know, if an organisation is, as the GAA rightly is, so proud of its history, that there's, you know, a good reason to keep educating the members in that history and why that the names and symbols and so on are important to the association.
Okay. Mick Foley of the Sunday Times, thanks very much, Mick. And Brian Hanley, historian, thanks very much as well.